Accession number 8667, rule number 1.
Mr. Boughton, Reel 1. Can you tell me a little of your family background, Mr. Boughton?
My family background? Well, I was born in 1895 in Kentish Town in London. My father was a tailor, a journeyman tailor with his own business, and I had a brother, an elder brother at that time, and then afterwards I had two sisters. That it was a hard life. I believe he paid 7 and 6 a week for the house that we had, for about 3 stories. And I went to a higher grade school and eventually left there when I was 15. And I'd always had very bad eyesight. And when I was at school, I had to go right out in front of the class to read the things on the blackboard. And I believe at one time that I had about 3 months away from school because they said that I shouldn't do any writing or clerical work. And my mother used to take me to the ophthalmic hospital in Gray's Inn Road. And it was one of the joys to go there because the first electric trams ran up Gray's Inn Road from King's Cross to Holborn. I believe the journey was a penny because all the other trams at that time were horse trams. But so it was a great experience to go there and get on these electric trams. But at the hospital, a bit different to today, when you went in, there was rows and rows of wooden benches upon which you sat, and then you saw the almoner, and they asked how much you could pay. Most people paid tuppence or threepence, but if you paid a half a crown, I think it was, you could get up to the front and see the optician quicker. And I can still remember the optician's name, a Mr. Archer. But he told my mother that he thought that possibly I might go blind when I got older, which didn't cheer us up very much. I'd had measles 3 times, and the last time it was inwardly, and they always said that it was those measles that caused my bad eyesight. But anyway, I always managed. I went in for sport a lot, and then I say when I was I did well at school, left there when I was 16, and I was always told that I shouldn't take a clerical job, and of course immediately I went into an office at a firm in High Holborn, and in those days named Charles Baker and Company Limited were really one of the first firms that ever started a store, even before Selfridges. Only then they had the first store in London, and I was in the export department. But anyway, when I was 15, I joined the Royal Fusilier Cadets in Pond Street at Hampstead. It was run by a gentleman. He was Lieutenant Colonel Carlebach, and he was of German extraction. But he was a very loyal Englishman, and he used to pay for all our uniforms. We had the full dress uniform, just the same as the regulars did, and he even paid for the Hampstead Brass Band to have uniforms and be our band on when we went on route marches. And he used to engage officers from the Guards Battalions to come up and train us twice a week. So we were really very, very fit. As a matter of fact, we were better drilled than a lot of the Territorial Battalions. But I was there from, I think it was 1912 when I joined. Yes, 1912. Well, then when war broke out, the cadet battalion all joined the 1st Battalion Royal Fusiliers Territorials. But I couldn't get in because I was turned out with bad eyesight. So I was disappointed, and all the other boys joined up, but I was left behind. I was anxious to go, so I went round everywhere to try to get into various battalions. Tried the Queen's Westminsters, the London Scottish, London Rifle Brigade, but I couldn't get in anywhere. Always I was fit to the last minute, and then they'd say, eyesight, no good, out. So when I was in Holborn one Saturday, a chap dashed in the office and said, "They're forming a battalion at the Handel Street headquarters of the Royal Fusiliers, and they want to form it in 2 days. So the medical exam is very brief. He says, pop down and see if you get in. He says, I reckon you'll get in. So I dashed out of the office and went down to Handel Street and found this headquarters. And sure enough, there was crowds of chaps. We were all lined around a drill hall, and the medical officer simply walked round and asked all a few odd questions, just say, are you quite fit? And if he thought you didn't look fit, he would test you. And then he would point round and say, how many things are there up there? How many lines are there? What's the time of the clock? I couldn't see them, but when he turned his back, I moved past him. And finally I got passed in and sworn in, and I was in the army, and that was September the 5th, 1914. And we got a shilling a day pay and 2 shillings a day subsistence allowance for living at home. So we used to go from Handel Street and drill on the grounds of the Foundling Hospital in London, and we drilled there for a long while. I forget how many weeks or two, and we used to march through London, because some of us have got uniform jackets and ordinary trousers, others have got ordinary jackets and uniform trousers, caps and bowler hats, and we used to march through London with all the people cheering us as we went by, a motley crowd we were. But I always remember one route march we used to do was to Wimbledon. And strangely enough, we used to sing a song, from Wimbledon to Wimbledon is 40 miles, from Wimbledon to Wimbledon is 40 miles. Now, not long ago you heard about the Wombies, but I suddenly thought we used to call it Wimbledon in those days, you see. But anyway, from then we went to Tunbridge, down in Kent, and we were billeted in various houses all around the town, 2 or 3 boys in anybody who could take us. And the lorries used to bring round the meat from our headquarters and leave it with the various people who were looking after us. And then we used to go at 7 o'clock in the morning in hot pickers trains to a place called Knockholt, where we dug trenches for the supposed defence of London. We had some shocking journeys, because it was very cold that winter, with loads of snow, and there was no lights in the carriages. But we enjoyed it, and the people in Tunbridge looked after us very, very well. But although the vicar of the local church issued instructions to his parishioners, don't let your daughters go out because we have the soldiers come in to stay. Yes. But anyway, we enjoyed our life there. And then we suddenly heard that we were going to Malta. And we had 24 hours leave, that was all, before we went. And we were allowed to dash up to London and say goodbye to our parents and catch a train back to Victoria. And what a send-off we had. Everybody came down to see us off. And it was really a marvellous experience to see all these people cheering us off on the train back to Tunbridge. And what did we leave? I forgot what day we left now. But anyway, I know it was early in 1915 when we left Tunbridge, and we went to Southampton, and we were embarked on a troop ship. Well, it was a cargo ship, actually, called the Galeka, G-A-L-E-E-K-A, a one-funnel cargo ship with no cargo on, and we left Southampton at about 10 o'clock one night. We were also battened below decks because there were submarines lurking outside, and we weren't allowed to go on the deck. Well, we started off all right, and then we suddenly went off on the course to America. And as a matter of fact, the ship flew the American flag, and there was a stink about it afterwards because they did that. That was to confuse the submarines. Well, there was a submarine there, and in the darkness there was a hospital ship, the Prince Asturias, that left just about our time, and the German submarine sank this hospital ship. And I believe you will find that is the first hospital ship that was sunk in that war. But we went on safely, but we had a terrible journey afterwards through the bay. The captain of the ship said that it was one of the roughest journeys that he'd ever experienced. We had a 2-destroyer escort, but it was so rough that they had to return to Southampton because
They were nearly swamped. There was 5,000 troops on board the Galeka, and I think there was 4,999 of them who were sick. And all they seemed to keep bringing up was dixies of fatty stew. And of course, every time we felt a bit better, they'd set us off again. And the chaps were lying about all over the deck, covered in vomit and goodness knows what, and we were all afraid that we were going to die, and the next minute we were afraid we weren't, because we felt so bad. Anyhow, we eventually... and the big moan was, why the hell did we sign for foreign service? Because then it was voluntary to sign for foreign service. Anyhow, on the Sunday morning, we arrived at Gibraltar. And what a change. There it was. It was a gorgeous sunny morning, lovely blue sea, calm, and the old rock sticking up there, you know, out of our history books. And we thought this was marvellous. Anyway, there were several chaps had to be put ashore because they were so ill. And then after that, we sailed away to Malta. And really, we thought, what a marvellous life. And everybody said, thank God we signed for foreign service. And we used to lay about on the deck, play cards, crown and anchor, and goodness knows what. And it was a really marvellous trip to Malta. Well, we got to Malta on February the 11th, and we pulled up in St. Paul's Bay, where St. Paul landed so many years before, in the evening, but it was too late to get into the Grand Harbour, because at dusk, a boom was placed right across the Grand Harbour. So we had to anchor for the night in St. Paul's Bay. Of course, we were soon surrounded by Maltese boats, all wanting to sell oranges and fruit and goodness knows what, and it was such a change of life for us to see all this different scenery. Remember, we were only young boys, about 19, and a lot of them came from terribly poor districts. This battalion was formed in record time, and there was a whole crowd of them who were costermongers, barrow boys and such like. So it was something out of this world for them. Well, early the next morning, we sailed into the Grand Harbour, and what a sight that was. There was all the fleet in there, our fleet, the French fleet, the Paris, the big French dreadnought, and all the sailors rushed up on deck and played their national anthems and cheered us and saluted us, and the guns fired from the battery, and we really thought we were heroes. But it was a really wonderful sight that I can still see when I can shut my eyes. Well, we landed on a quay. Of course, we're immediately surrounded by gippos with oranges and figs and God knows what, and the first time we'd ever seen oranges with leaves on. But at the same time as we disembarked, there was the 1st, 2nd, 3rd and 4th battalions of the Royal Fusiliers, and the 1st battalions of that lot, each 1st battalion had gone to Malta at the outbreak of war, because the regular garrisons had all been sent to France. And as we landed, these four battalions were ready, lined up to take our place on the boat to go back to France. But amongst these battalions and our battalion, there were several relatives, brothers and cousins, who had relatives in the 1st battalion, and they wanted to see them. So there was a near riot for a little while, and eventually they got a stay of execution to stop the chaps going aboard until we'd all mingled and seen our friends and relatives. Yeah. And then the 1st battalions left us, went abroad and sailed away to France, where I think they were nearly all wiped out pretty well. And we then dispersed to our various barracks. We went to St. George's Barracks, very nice place, and about a dozen of us in the barrack room. And of course, everything was so new and strange to us. It was a new world to us. But it was a hard life. We were trained by the Royal Marines and the Royal Garrison Artillery, Maltese Royal Garrison Artillery. And they gave us a real tough time. And I now remember that reveille used to be at 4 o'clock each morning. And then we used to do night manoeuvres about 3 or 4 nights a week. And we did in 6 months what the regulars used to do in 2 years in the way of training. And a lot of chaps, of course, couldn't stand it, passed out, and were sent back to England. But anyway, it was a great life, and we enjoyed Malta. It was a lovely island to us, but of course we were always getting into trouble, one thing and another. And on one occasion, the food was very bad there. It turned out afterwards that the quartermaster was fiddling the accounts. And we were supplied with meat and stuff. We all swore it was goat that you couldn't eat, and other various things, tin butter that was rancid. And on one day, there was a big rally at Hyntothea. I'll tell you how to spell that. It's in the north of the island. And it was, I can't remember now whether it was Lord Methuen or Lord Lucan, either one of them, who was the governor, was taking the big parade. And the four battalions of fusiliers, we were all supposed to march to Hyntothea for this review. Well, the 3rd battalion in the Royal Fusiliers, they'd had a very bad time, and they started came round and started a mutiny and told everybody not to go on the parade when the bugles went in the morning. And we all agreed, because we were all fed up with the food. Anyway, when the bugles went, nobody turned out for the fall-in. The non-coms and the officers chased round trying to get us on parade, but we couldn't go. That was a mutiny that I don't think I've ever seen mentioned anywhere else. Anyway, there was a proper stink about it, and we were all threatened with court-martials, and I think that in the end, the 3rd Battalion was sent to Khartoum for punishment, and we were confined to barracks, for some weeks, but there was always ways of getting out. Anyway, having finished our training, we were waiting to go, we didn't know where, but we'd heard rumours that about the Dardanelles campaign. Everybody knew that it was going to start, but they didn't know when. So, I mean, all the spies and Turks, they must have known just as well. They did know, because they fortified all the Dardanelles and laid barbed wire all in the water and everything else through hearing about these proposed landings. But I remember on one day we had to, when after the landing had started at Cape Helles, some hospital ships came in, and we were ordered down to the docks to help unload the wounded. And what a terrible sight that was, to see all these chaps. Some of them had been 3 days on the boat from Cape Helles and never had their wounds dressed. The doctors had been working day and night amputating limbs and dressing wounds. And I remember one of our fellows, he was near the operating room, and somebody suddenly opened the door and handed him a severed leg and told him to take it down to the border room. He promptly passed out. But it was shocking to see those fellas. But we got them ashore eventually, and of course all our barracks had then been taken over to be used for hospitals for the Australians, and we were billeted in schools in Sleema instead. But we used to be on guard at night outside these hospitals, and it was pitiful to hear the cries and screams of these chaps who were recounting their adventures in the landing. And of course some of the stories that they told us didn't really encourage us, because we knew that later on we would be going up there. Anyway, so we did. Then the time came when we were moved on to Egypt, and we went on a boat, the Ivernia. And we had the best time on that boat. We were treated like first-class passengers. We had bunks and we had marvellous food. And it was about 3 days' journey to Alexandria. And it was a wonderful voyage. And they treated us really just like first-class tourists. And then we finally reached Alexandria. It was another experience to see all these marvellous places. We landed at Alexandria and went into a camp, the place called, I think it was Sidi Bish, S-I-D-I-B-I-S-H, I think it was, dear, Sidi Bish. When the Ivernia had disembarked us and left the harbour, she was sunk by a submarine. But we went into this camp and were prepared for, we were told then that we were going up to Suvla Bay, up to Cape Helles. I get it right, up to the peninsula, I get it right in a minute. And we had about, I think, 2 injections for typhoid and God knows what. Our hair was all shaved off, chaps with long hair. They looked like convicts when they came out, because they said that the place was so alive with lice and that we must have all our hair off, which we did. Then we had the 2 inoculations, which made us as stiff as anything. But we did manage to get to the pyramids and see them. I said, I'm not coming to Egypt unless I see the pyramids, which we did. There was the Australians, while we were there, started a riot in Cairo, and it was known as the Battle of the Wazza, W-A-Z-Z-I-R, I think that was. Apparently some of their chaps had been badly treated in the red light district, and the Australians went up there one day, crowds of them, to take revenge. And they set dozens of houses alight, threw all the furniture out the windows. There was a terrific shemozzle there for hours, and I believe two of the military police were the Devlin military police were killed in the riots. Afterwards, the Australians raided all the houses, took furniture out, raided the pubs and beer barrels, were placed on carts and carted away to the camp, and for two or three days they were absolutely uncontrollable, and there was a real riot. But eventually they got calmed down. Now, I've never seen that mentioned anywhere else, but it was known, as I say, as the Battle of the Wazza amongst the local troops. Anyway, that passed on. Where do we get to next? Well, then the night came when we were told we were going up to Suvla Bay. And we went up on a cattle boat, that's right, on a cattle boat from Alexandria to Mudros. And it had been used for taking mules up to the peninsula, and we were berthed in the stalls where these mules had been, and there was all the dung and refuse and everything still there, and that's what we had to lay down amongst for rest. But so we were so fed up with that that we used to go out and sleep on deck and to get some fresh air. But anyway, we eventually got to Mural. I forget how long that took us. Not long, two or three days I think it was. And we were re-kitted out there and supplied with ammunition and goodness knows what. And then one night we were taken up by a little steamer that used to travel around the locks in Scotland, and off we sailed to Suvla Bay. Now, we got there when it was dark, that I remember, because there was a flap going on in the trenches, and you could see all the Veery lights and all the gunfire and everything else, and we thought, well, this is a nice place to get to. But it was a very quite a rough night. Well, we had to land from this pleasure steamer, as it was, onto small barges, and the sea was rough, and we got all our equipment on, a heavy pack, overcoats, rifles, ammunition, and we had to the boat we went into was just a small barge, and the boats were going up and down like a seesaw, and one minute they were about 10 feet below you, the next minute they were about 10 minutes, the barge was about 10 minutes above you, and you were supposed to jump when the two boats got level, and somebody would yell, jump! Well, if you missed a jump, you either missed the side of the boat and fell in the sea, or else you fell in the boat and nearly broke your limbs. But we got off eventually, and then we were towed in these little motor barges to the shore, and I know we were hastily rushed off the boats and marched to some space, I don't know where it was because it was dark, and we were told to dig in as quick as we could because we would be in full view of the Turks in the morning. So we dug like mad, and it was very difficult to dig because the ground was very hard, but we made some sorts of holes and cover, and shells were coming over and bullets and whatnot, and everybody had the wind up, rather, first time being under fire. But we dug in, and then in the morning we were taken up the line by some of the old 29th Division troops. I think it was the Worcesters, but the old regular troops from India. And of course they didn't think much of our boys. I mean, we were just novices and weren't very good at that. But anyway, they took us up and showed us where we had to go, through these tiny narrow trenches and up to the front line, which wasn't much, very little protection. And from then on, well, we had a pretty hard life. Rations were bad and short. Our daily ration consisted chiefly of a tin of bully beef, three hard biscuits, and if you were lucky, a mess tin lid of water, which you poured into your water bottle and saved for emergency. But the water supply was very, very short because the Turks had poisoned what wells there were on Suvla. So the water supply that we had to come from Egypt, a 3-day journey in a boat, and then it was pumped into small rowing boats, and the rowing boats were towed ashore at night, and it was ladled into what were called camel tanks, about the size of a large portmanteau, and the Gurkhas used to bring it up at night on mules, and then it was served out in the morning. And I say you were lucky if you got a mess tin lid full, which wasn't much because it was hot then. And it was terrible. Very often there were chaps who were dying or wounded and crying for water, and you hadn't got any water to give them. You only had sufficient for your own use, and you couldn't afford to give any away. You would in a desperate case, but there are, consequently, you went without. And that went on for a long while, the water shortage, which was dreadful. And I say, with the only bully beef and three hard biscuits, life was very, very, very tough. And there was no facilities to buy anything or to get any further supplies. There was no naffy or kaffis or anything on there. All you had was what you brought on yourself, and that didn't last very long. I mean, cigarettes and other little necessities, they all disappeared. And it got very tough indeed. And I say, even the chaps who were wounded, you couldn't give them anything, and they had to be carried down to the beach. That was the nearest place. There were no roads. You had to struggle through tiny, narrow, shallow trenches to take these chaps down to the beach, or else they had to crawl down on their own. And I'll say the life was very, very tough. And of course, one of the biggest curses was the flies. There was millions and millions and millions of flies. The whole of the side of the trench used to be one black swarming mass. And anything if you opened a tin of bully or went to eat a biscuit, in the next minute it'd be swarming with flies all around your mouth, on any cuts or sores that you've got, which all turns septic through it. And it was a curse, really. It really was. And we almost gave up hope at times of whether we would ever get off. The fighting, that had died down a lot, of course, from the time when the first landing was made. There were sporadic attacks to straighten bits of the line out or to get rid of some Turks who were in a position where they were sniping at us and carving us up. But then at night time there'd be night patrols and a night attack to get some Turkish prisoners to find out what was going on over the other side. And of course they held all the best positions above us, and we were at a dead loss, really. And very often they were in a position to enfilade our trenches and snipe us every time anybody moved. So the casualties were pretty heavy. But I say one of the things that I remember very much was when we were in a bad position, like very often, because the dreadnought, the Queen Lizzie, she lay in the bay down below, and when they got a bit too annoying, she would open a bombardment along the Turkish trenches, along with a big monitor that was in the bay and any odd destroyers. And we would hear that there was going to be a bombardment at say 10 a.m. and actually on that moment the bombardment would start, and it was a sight to see. You would see the Lizzie Lane in the bay. She was only 2 miles from the bay, and you would see a circle of smoke and a flash,
and then you would hear these shells screaming over like express trains, and all the Turkish lines would be going up and down like fountains.